Okay, we are now live on YouTube, and I just want to thank everyone if you're watching this live or if you're watching the replay for watching the replay. I'm here today with one of our very own founding members and one of our very own authors that has written her own book. Her name is Rebecca Tripp. She wrote a book, I don't even know how many years ago it was now. How many years ago did you write this
Came
book?
out in 2014.
2014, so it's just over 7 years old now, and she wrote this book from stuff that she was going through, and she is going to actually do a book study on her own book. So what better than to join a book study from the actual author who actually wrote the book? So the exact date hasn't been chosen yet. We do know it's going to be in February at some point. We're just getting all the materials ready now, so def if you if this interests you and you want to join, I'd highly recommend to join with Rebecca. She's even giving a special introductory offer for the very first one that she's doing. After that, the prices will go up, so you definitely don't want to miss it. And it's going to be definitely one of a kind. And there's not too many times when you get to do live book studies with the actual author. Like, how cool would it be if you were doing a live book study with Napoleon Hill or someone like that, and then Think and Grow Rich? That would be pretty wild. But what we wanted to do today was just for anyone who doesn't know who Rebecca is, just to kind of get her complete story on, who she is, what she's done, where she is, and why she's doing the things that she's doing now. So, Rebecca, maybe tell us, start a little bit in your past. Tell us a little bit about, you're growing up and how you sort of grew up and how you sort of got to where you were and how you ended up writing the book.
Okay, well, starting with my long ago past, I'm from Westport, Massachusetts, and I was born the same year as our president, Donald Trump. I was born in 1946. I'm a few days older than him. So I get why he wants to make America great again. But, that was right after World War II. And I'm convinced that I'm one of these light worker types that came in. We heard the call, and here I am. I know you two are both light workers too that are on the call with me right now. And we're here to help the planet. So I was guided, though, when I got out of college to, and I thought about it when I was about 12 years old for the first time. My father came home from a business trip and gave me an application to be a stewardess because he had taken a trip, and he, for some reason, he came home with his stewardess application, and it really got my attention. And I'm a product of the 60s when women really couldn't do a lot of career things that they do today. We couldn't be pilots for big airlines. We couldn't be CEOs. We couldn't do a lot of things, but stewardesses could do everything in a man's world as far as traveling and cruising around. So I really wanted to be a stewardess because I love travel and it just sounded fascinating. So I applied and I got a job. I started flying in 1967 with United Airlines, which turned out to be the perfect airline for me because Pan American went bankrupt during my career. I originally applied with TWA, Trans World Airways, and they rejected me, and I was devastated, but they went bankrupt. Eastern Airlines hired me. They went bankrupt. And but I picked United, and they hung in there. So I was able to have a 35-year career with United Airlines, and I met amazing people. As soon as I started flying, I met a man when I was based in Chicago, my first base. I was living in this building in downtown Chicago, and it was all stewardesses. But these two men moved in. There was a man who managed the building, and then these two guys moved in and befriended my roommate and me. And one of them was the nephew of a very, very famous metaphysical teacher named Earl Schoaf. My friend's name was Ron, and he knew how to manifest. He knew the secrets of using creative visualization. So he taught me how to do it, and I tried it. Now, I really wanted to be based in New York. So I wrote down on a card, I am now living in New York in a beautiful apartment, and within a matter of weeks, I talked my roommate into moving. Our transfers went through. We walked into Manhattan and rented a beautiful apartment. And I said to myself, this is amazing. I really realized that within us, using our imagination, is a magical genie in a bottle that we can tap into. And I started using it more and more and more to manifest things, and had just, you know, tremendous results. So I started reading all the books on how to manifest consciousness. I was the seeker even before this. I was always wondering what were we doing here on planet Earth, but I began to get answers. And I continued my flying career. And then I had a big epiphany when I had a spiritual healing of the belief of cancer, because I found myself, after studying a lot of metaphysical books, finally needing to put my money where my mouth was, so to speak, because I was tested. A doctor wanted to do surgery. I did not want surgery in any way, shape, or form, but I was filled with fear because he said, if you don't, you'll be dead by the time you're 40. So I went to a spiritual healer, took the leap of faith that God could heal me, and had a spontaneous healing. Not only did it change my body, but it changed my consciousness. I went into a much higher state of consciousness, and everything shifted for me. Not that my life, I mean, I was in my mid-20s. Not that I didn't go through a lot of life lessons after that. There were three husbands in this book. but I don't regret being married three times. I learned amazing things going through all these experiences. But I flew for 35 years. And then after I retired, because of 9/11, I didn't want to be using my body like I was playing Russian roulette after that, because I really had this feeling that there was a lot more to 9/11 than met the eye. I mean, I didn't understand how, with the amazing intelligence departments we have, like the CIA, the FBI, and whatever else is going on, they didn't pick this one up on the radar. Well, I was supposed to be on the second airplane that hit the tower because I bid for it. I was based in Boston by then. And because I was the most senior person in the base, I always got my first bid, and that was what I bid, flight 175. But at the last minute, I changed my bid because I got into a conversation with my friend, Brian, and he talked me into a different layover hotel. So I went to the computer and changed the bid. But after that, I didn't really enjoy flying anymore, you know, because there were all kinds of crazy things going on after 9/11. It just wasn't the same. So I retired, but I had 35 years, so that was enough. And then for 2 years, I tried to figure out what can I do next. And I didn't want to do any of the things I had done in my previous life, because I'd always had tandem careers along with being a flight attendant. I'd sold real estate. I'd owned two different boutiques. I'd owned a modeling agency in New York. I'd gotten my real estate license I was a financial planner for a while. I'd done a lot of things. I enjoy doing things to check things out, but none of that amused me. So I kept trying to figure out what should I do. And then after I completely surrendered and gave up, I discovered that the people ran the Silva Ultramind business, which is the work of Jose Silva, were looking for trainers. And I said to myself, that's what I should do, because I love metaphysics. And I've been studying manifesting and spiritual healing and all these things for decades. So I became a trainer for the Silva Ultramind program, trained about 3,000 people all over the country doing seminars. It's a 2-day seminar. And after my marketing person moved on, that slowed down. But the students were always asking me to write a book because they wanted to know why I was so interested in metaphysics and spirituality. So then I spent 3 years working with a ghostwriter and wrote the book that came out in 2014. And I did some other metaphysical part-time jobs. Like I worked as a tour guide at a landmark church in Boston, giving tours to people from all over the world. I've been involved in the transformational world now. I became a certified tapping into wealth coach, and I've helped some people with coaching. And I just love transformation. But like all light workers, I feel like I came here to help the planet go through the transition it's going through right now. I do believe there's a very big shift in consciousness taking place. There's other dimensions opening up. You know, the fifth dimension is what people are talking about a lot. To me, that is the same as the Christ consciousness, which you can tap into, where you can solve problems, you can heal yourself, you can manifest. And once you figure out how to get there in your thinking, in your consciousness, it's always there for you. So that's why I enjoy helping people and teaching them, because once you get that, you go from having anxiety and stress to being at peace. And there's nothing better than having inner peace. It's much better than living in a state of despair, stress, misery, which is what a lot of the planet still does, of course, because this is a classroom and we're all operating at different levels of consciousness. But there are very, very simple techniques to free yourself. And that's what I'm all about.
Cool. Well, that is awesome. I love your story. I've heard it a few times, so definitely is good. So tell us a little bit about your book. And so tell us, you know, let's start with chapter one. Why is chapter one, you know, why did you write it? You know, what's the title of it?
Okay. Well, the title of the chapter one is called Breaking the Rules. And I put a quote at the beginning of each chapter. Chapter one is a quote from Marilyn Monroe. If I'd observed all the rules, I'd never gotten anywhere. I like that. Because you want to know something? We're living in a time right now where there's a lot of people following the rules, right? And it's making them crazy because they're so worried that they're breaking the rules. Well, who made the rules in the first place? Humans, right?
Government.
Okay, so I give the example in this book of the first sign I got as a thinking human being that there were rules. Now, when I was a little girl, we didn't go to kindergarten. We just went to first grade. And I was so excited to go to first grade because I knew that people could look at a piece of paper that had marks on it and writing and interpret it and read books, you know, and understand what they were looking at. And I could read a little bit, but not enough to really enjoy it that much. And I really wanted to learn how to read. I thought I was going to go to school and learn how to read the first day. Well, the first day of school for me became embedded in my consciousness because I had such an experience of realizing you can break the rules. We were sitting in a circle, all the little first graders on the first day. The teacher, who was really a very nice lady, was sitting there with us. I ended up liking her a lot. She was one of the nicest teachers in the school. Well, anyway, we were sitting there and I had just learned how to whistle that week. So I just decided I would whistle to share it with everyone because I thought it was kind of a cool thing. Mm-hmm. Well, the teacher looked at me and it shocked me because I can still remember how she looked at me. And she said, Rebecca, we don't whistle in school. And I still remember to this day the dress I had on, the shoes I had on, because it was one of those moments. Now, that's how we program children. Mm-hmm. We train them to obey the rules. Mm-hmm. And that's what the educational system, a good part of it, is about. Mm-hmm. And then pretty soon, you're afraid to break a rule, mm-hmm. unless you're a real independent thinker. Or you do some soul searching or digging or you read books or you figure something out that frees you from all that programming. That's what the Silva Ultramind training is about. Cool. We're all programmed. We can't help it. As soon as we come out and we're born, we start getting programmed by our families, our communities, our, you know, the world. And, but it depends on how you react to programming. Now, that certainly was a very, very kind of big event for me because it left such an impression. And, you know, I'm the kind of person who has a very independent spirit. So it didn't make any sense to me. My immediate reaction within myself was, what kind of a place is this? Why would someone say that to me? Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't really say anything, but it was, and then of course you're a little embarrassed when you're in front of your peers. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happened. Mankind doesn't really live their full potential because they've been so beaten down. Many times it's unintentional. They're just trying to make people be good, mm-hmm. or, you know, not get in trouble, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of rules. Mm-hmm. And they're all man-made. So you have to ask yourself, which rules do I live by? And one of the reasons I wrote this book is because after you figure out there are the rules of the 3D world where you can operate, but there are also rules that are from a higher order that, you know, the laws of reciprocity, the laws of attraction, you know, what you give out is what you get back. There's all kinds of other laws that you can study in metaphysics that are true and eternal, because human laws can be changed every day of the week. Who would have thought we'd end up in a situation we're in now globally, where we got all these rules that people are supposed to follow? And it's, instead of progressing us, it's kind of moving us backwards. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So tell us, what's chapter two about?
Chapter two is called, let's see, See It, Believe It. That's when I met the man who taught me how to use creative visualization. And that was a big epiphany for me. And I told you the story earlier in the interview, but I remember when I got it, my gosh, what we think about, what we visualize, what we use our imagination to create in our lives is what we're experiencing. I really got that. Mm-hmm. I was really frustrated to think they don't teach it in the churches, most of them. Some of the New Age churches started teaching it, but the traditional older churches always made people think you're not good enough. Mm-hmm. You're a miserable sinner. You gotta wait until you die until you get the good stuff, right? Okay. And they don't teach it in colleges. Mm-hmm. Very hard to, I mean, I don't even think there's that many colleges that even have a decent course in metaphysics. You know, there have always been mystery schools and secret organizations where you can go and study and meditate and learn how to do these things, but it's not mainstream. Mm-hmm. So that was a real shocker to me, that you can be raised in a decent culture, society, with parents that are okay, but they don't know any of this stuff. Nobody can teach it to you. You've got to go find it yourself. That's why they call it the pearl of great price, mm-hmm. because you can tell it to someone, but if they're not ready to hear it, they're not going to hear it anyway. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's chapter two. Okay. I get into that.
Tell me about chapter three.
Chapter three is called Baggage. Now, crew members fly all over the world carrying their baggage, and it's just one suitcase and a tote bag. So you got to be real careful what you put in that bag, because if you're in Singapore or Hong Kong or, you know, Frankfurt, you want to make sure you get something with you that you really wanted to bring. Mm-hmm. If you forget it, forget it, you know, you don't have it. So, but it's always good to travel light. Like I would carry these little tiny containers with cosmetics in them, because weight is very important when you're flying around the world, dragging a suitcase. You don't want it to be too heavy. Mm-hmm. That's another biggie. Mm-hmm. And it's just like life. If you're carrying a lot of baggage, be it mental or even physical baggage, like a lot of stuff, that can drag you down. Mm-hmm. It can really drag you down, because you can be much more of a metaphysical thinker when, that's why monks and metaphysical people like to live in little ashrams and, you know, simple places, because they don't have to think about all that stuff. they can just think, meditate, go within. Makes it simple. And it can be very powerful. So I did a whole thing on baggage because of that.
Good. Interesting.
Yeah.
Chapter 4?
The French twist. Now, this is all about confidence. I was on a flight going to Narita one afternoon because we used to leave Kennedy Airport about 1 o'clock in the afternoon for a 14-hour flight nonstop to Narita, Japan, which you fly across the country way up toward the North Pole because of the curve of the earth. It's a long flight, 14 hours. And it was a beautiful 747 that we would be on, and I'd be working in first class. So I'm going around asking the passengers if they'd like a pre-departure cocktail, mimosa, whatever. And I get to this man and he's kind of grumpy. And he said to me, I used to wear my hair in a French twist. And he said, your French twist is crooked. And I said to myself, really? And it was kind of like, threw me off a little bit and made me a little uncomfortable. And I started to think, gee, maybe I don't look too good. But then I thought about it. I said, no, I think my French twist is okay. And I think I look okay today. So I walked away, and being an intuitive empath, I said to myself, what could be wrong with this guy that he would even say that? Mm-hmm. Then it dawned on me. I bet he had a fight with his wife before he left. Mm. It's a long flight. Mm-hmm. Things can happen before you go on these long trips. So I went up to him and I said, so what happened? Did you have a fight with your wife this morning? Immediately he said to me, to tell you the truth, we haven't had a good relationship for years. Mm. That was the whole problem. Mm-hmm. Now, in this day and age, he could have been removed from the flight for mm-hmm. saying something rude to a crew member, and they might have done it, but it didn't bother me. So I decided to just let him go. After that, he was as nice as could be. But mm-hmm. see, if you are empowered enough to be confident when people throw rocks at you, you deflect them. You don't absorb them, you deflect them.
Nice.
And that's what I did. You know, it's kind of an example of that.
Okay. I think that's so cool, Rebecca, because it reminds me, like my heart, he wears a kilt a lot. And he gets a lot of pushback sometimes from men. Women love it, but from men.
Yeah.
And he says, does this bother you? And I told him, I said, you know what? It takes somebody with a lot of confidence to go against the flow.
Yeah.
Well, and I see that in you.
Well, think about what Jesus said when he was being crucified and the two other dudes were there. Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. And humans, I realize now, because I've spent so many years studying consciousness, if you're not functioning from the higher levels of consciousness, you can do and say and be mean and react to people. And, you know, that's just the way humans operate. It's challenging because we're all in this three-dimensional world together. Mm-hmm. But if you can remember how to be centered, you can deflect it.
Cool. Yeah. Tell us about the next chapter.
The next one is called The Bunny Club.
Okay. Interesting.
Well, that was an interesting chapter in my life. Well, I was living down, this was when I was in my 20s still, and I was living in New York City in Greenwich Village. And the Bunny Club was the big thing. I mean, it was big. I'm telling you, Gloria Steinem was a bunny. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, I can't think of her name. She's retired now. Famous, famous anchor woman. She was one. There were famous women that were bunnies. So it wasn't like a creepy thing to do. It was like very prestigious. Hmm. So I said to myself one day, I think I'll go down to that bunny club and see what's going on and apply just for mm-hmm. the heck of it. I think outside the box. So one of the games I would play with myself is I'm going to challenge myself today to go do something outrageous, right? Mm-hmm. So this particular day I said, okay, I had already called them up and they said, they gave me a date to come. So I went down there and I got a sign on my way down from the taxi driver. He said to me, your sister got married today. I said, my sister? I don't have a sister. He said, oh, Jackie Kennedy. He was joking. Mm-hmm. That was the day she married Onassis.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was kind of a sign because he was mistaking me for Jackie's sister. He didn't really, but So anyway, I got down to the Bunny Club. It was in the East 50s. And I had to go up the elevator to the bunny section where they, you know, hung out. And they had me put on a bunny costume and the ears and everything. And I'll tell you, you don't look like the same person, because the whole corset part of it is made out of metal. And they had this woman, he had to zip me into it. There's no way you can zip yourself in. It's like your ribs literally bend.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyway, I walk out of the dressing room and the manager just happened to be walking by. And he looked at me and he said, "You're hired." I said, "Oh, really?" He said, "Yeah, I'll go tell the bunny mother." So I walked into the bunny mother's, you know, area. She said, "You're hired." I said, "Oh, okay." And I filled out the paperwork and she gave me the bunny spiel. She said, "Here's the bunny manual. You know, you have to learn how to do the bunny dip and we'll train you on how to do everything." And then this creepy photographer came in and told me how much money I would make posing fully dressed, semi-dressed, nude, semi-nude. And I'm going, "Oh my God, this is creepy." But anyway, I walked out and I was supposed to go back that Monday. This was a Friday to get the training. I flew a trip to Seattle as a stewardess. And the bunny mother had told me, "You can't be a bunny and a stewardess. You're going to have to decide one or the other." So I get out to Seattle. I'm tossing and turning. Should I be a bunny? Should I be a stewardess? Because the bunnies made a lot of money. Mm-hmm. There was no limit on how much they could be tipped. And people were giving them, you know, mega bucks because they were all crazy. But anyway... So anyway, I'm in Seattle trying to sleep and I'm tossing and turning and I have this dream in the middle of the night that I'm doing the bunny dip. I'm all dressed up as a bunny and I've got this big fluffy cottontail, which was part of the costume, and people were pulling on the cottontail and I freaked out in my dream and I said, "That's it. I'll never go back." And I never went back.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was the end of that. Well, now I find out that whole bunny club thing with Hugh Hefner was a cover for these honeypots. He worked for the CIA.
Oh, wow.
I got a bad feeling in the place.
Oh, wow.
You know, I just didn't like the vibe.
Wow.
But like I say, it was considered a very prestigious job to get. It was almost like being a movie star.
Wow.
But so anyway, that was the bunny thing. The reason I wrote that chapter is because it expresses, like, the manager hired me like that. All he was interested in was how I looked.
Mm-hmm.
I could have been a killer,
mm-hmm,
or a thief, or, you know, he didn't even look at my resume.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Body identity.
Mm-hmm.
Body identity is, and you know, people that want to pump iron all day long and people that want to have plastic surgery every year. And there's a lot of body identity in our culture, but it can make you crazy, you know, if you're not careful.
Exactly.
So that's why I wrote about body identity.
Okay.
Yeah. Great expectations. You know, that chapter, honestly, you create your universe as you go along. And that could be the one where I'm talking about my Mother Teresa moment.
Mm-hmm.
I was standing in the aisle of an airplane and it was a full load. And I was doing the beverage service and people had a tendency to pull on your smock behind you if, mm-hmm, they wanted your attention or tap you.
Mm-hmm.
It was very, very, very irritating sometimes if you weren't in just the right mood.
Mm-hmm.
And I was still in the state of mind as a flight attendant where they could irritate the hell out of me.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the nice tests about working with the public. You get to find out how much they can irritate you. Really, and it's a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to always be saying to myself, what you resist persists.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you get to a point where you just want to be out of there. You don't want to be there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I'm in the aisle and they're all pulling on me and pulling on me. And I was just about to really let out a scream.
Mm-hmm.
But there was always this story that circulated in the 60s that was famous about this stewardess who was serving dinners to people and she flipped out. She had that moment and she couldn't control it. Mm-hmm. And she started picking up the food and throwing it at them, saying, "Peas, I'll give you peas." It was a famous story. And all I could think of was, oh my God, I don't want to become a legend like her. So I calmed myself down. All of a sudden, I kid you not, I left my body. I felt my energy just go up. Mm-hmm. And at that same moment, I heard a voice and it said, "Love looseth me and lifteth me above hate's thrall."
Wow.
Now, those were words from a hymn that I knew. Mm-hmm. But it was a male voice and I heard it clearly. And at the same moment, I felt like I was Mother Teresa when I came back down into my body, feeding the starving people in Calcutta and doing it with love instead of, I want out of here. And it shifted me. It shifted me. And then later on, I was on a flight with this good-looking steward and we were working first class together. Now I was above it all after that. They never bothered me again, the passengers. Mm-hmm. And he was going cuckoo in first class because they kept, you know, demanding things and acting kind of weird with him. So I explained to him my Mother Teresa moment. He calmed right down. Mm. He got it. I said, you can't go down into the snake pit. You have to stay above it. Mm-hmm. And I used to share that with a lot of crew members, including pilots, even though they weren't working in the cabin. But yeah, if you stay above it. And right now we are being so challenged by family members, friends, you know, there's different points of view about what's going on the planet. And if you get down into it with them, you're not going to communicate.
Yeah, exactly.
You got to just accept we live in two worlds.
Exactly.
You know, so, you know, but you have to learn those lessons because I always thought the passengers were there to amuse me mm-hmm. until I had the Mother Teresa moment. And then from then on, I was like Mother Teresa serving the poor starving people in Calcutta. And they didn't bother me anymore. Mm-hmm. I didn't expect them to be good.
Awesome. Tell us about the next chapter.
All right, the next one is called The New Illusion. The New Illusion. You must choose between your attachments and happiness. Mm. Now, this is the thing. I think my third husband is in this chapter. All my husbands are in these chapters. Mm-hmm. The first one was an unbelievably good-looking international model. And I had wanted to have a modeling agency in New York. So I attracted him and we manifested a modeling agency. But that marriage lasted 3 years. And then the third husband, he was a trust fund baby. And he loved antiques. And all of his relatives were billionaires. He wasn't a billionaire, but his relatives were. So he was around a lot of rich people. And he loved beautiful antiques. Because he grew up with them, but he liked antiques more than he liked people. Mm. Yeah, that's the problem. Yeah. See, this is the thing about attachments. Mm-hmm. If you like your stuff more than you like your spouse or your family, well, like one time we decided, Michael, you got to get rid of some of this stuff. Mm-hmm. So we had this girl come over that knew how to sell on eBay. Mm-hmm. So she taught him how to do it. You know, she had it and she said, "Okay, now let's test it out. Go get something you want to sell." Mm-hmm. He brought out this thing that was worth $2 because he couldn't get rid of his stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was a real lesson to me too, how attached people can be to their stuff. But you know, if you are attached to your stuff, it bogs you. It's just like anything else, you know, baggage.
Exactly. Energy. If everything is energy, you're just wasting more energy on it.
Exactly.
Okay. And tell us about the next one.
All right. The next one is you might need a private jet. Now that one. Oh yeah. Yeah. That was, yeah. The thing about a private jet is that people, you know, they want to have private jets, which is a good thing now. There weren't any private jets to speak of in the 60s. That's why we met all the celebrities and, you know, movers and shakers. And that was the fun part of it back in the 60s. Everybody was flying commercially. Now they have private jets. But the point of that chapter is that I talk about, well, that's where I talk about Flight 175, actually, which I spoke about earlier. And, you know, how I didn't want to fly anymore as a flight attendant after that, because there were too many things to think about. Guarding the cockpit door when they came out to use the bathroom, not being able to just pop up to the cockpit when you felt like it, because we always just, you know, had a secret knock. But then all of a sudden it was set up like Fort Knox. There was no way you could get in the cockpit unless, you know, you knew the secrets. And it just, you know, wasn't any fun anymore, because, and what I've observed in my life because of my age and my flying career, when I first started flying in the 60s, there was no security whatsoever. Mm-hmm. We could travel freely about the planet. And younger people don't even realize that we have been so confined now. Mm-hmm. Because of things like 9/11. Mm-hmm. But in the United States, it started with all those airplanes that were being hijacked to Cuba. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden they decided, oh, they like to take airplanes to Cuba. I could never figure out the point of it, because it seemed like they just got arrested when they got there. Mm-hmm. And nobody ever got killed. But there were some terrorist attacks overseas, you know, in the early 70s, they started blowing up airplanes. So they started with this whole security thing. Mm-hmm. And it's just gotten worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And I mean, being a person who loves freedom, I don't like restraints and constraints. And that's, it just keeps getting worse all the time. And people just think, oh, isn't this wonderful? We're so much safer. Well, guess what? Every year when I'd go to secure, we had to go to training, you know, to keep our certifications as flight attendants. And it was all about safety and crashes. And we would go over every major crash that had happened that year and even in past history, and talk about what we would do in certain situations if we were hijacked or if we crashed in the ocean, you know, all this kind of stuff. There's a lot of training involved with being a crew member, especially a flight attendant and a pilot. But people don't realize that. But, you know, one of the things they used to say to us every year, yeah, we're going to start seeing terrorist attacks on our own land here in America. And yeah, they're probably going to continue to try to blow up airplanes and do things. And I mean, crew members know that all the security stuff is more for show. Mm-hmm. Than anything. If you're a real demon and you want to do something like they did on 9/11, who knows how that went down? Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure the story we heard on the news is even close to the truth. Mm-hmm. But they will do things. Evil people will figure out how to, you know, bypass any kind of security measures. Mm-hmm. So it's just a waste of time, money, energy. It's psychologically damaging. And you know, that's what humans do.
Exactly.
Yep.
Isn't that where you first started with the Silva method, where you first heard about it?
What do you mean where I first heard about it?
Isn't that where, I think if I remember right in the book, that's when you first saw the information in a magazine or ad for the Silva training?
Oh, well, I bought a book. Yeah, I bought a book. And it was after I had been looking for a job for 2 years. Nothing had worked out. And I just surrendered to the point where I was crying. I was so upset. I said, I give up. Now that's when you always get your answers, when you completely surrender. So I did surrender. And the next day I went to Bristol, Rhode Island, bought a bunch of books that were on sale. And that I read this book that night, Silva Mind Control by Jose Silva. And they just happened to be looking for trainers. There was a little card or something in the book. I don't even know how I found out they were. It was perfect timing.
Nice.
That's why it took me 2 years to find the next thing. Cause I did that for 5 solid years all over the country, mm-hmm. giving Silva workshops. And then the last chapter is called skydiving. And skydiving, I was going to go skydiving because I was very, I mean, I took flying lessons when I first started flying. I would pilot. Well, when I started flying in the 60s, not only were there a lot of stewardesses in their 20s, because the cutoff was age 28. Mm-hmm. You could only be 20 to 28. You couldn't be married. We were Vestal virgins. That's what I called us. Vestal virgins. And anyway, there were all these young pilots they had hired. And so it was kind of fun. You know, there was always something to do. And these pilots loved being pilots. They just loved their jobs. And, you know, I would befriend one and they say, oh, would you like me to take you flying in a Cessna? And I go, yeah, that sounds like fun. Mm-hmm. And they even talked me into taking some flying lessons. Mm-hmm. I had a little log book and I was at the controls. But one time I was supposed to be taking off and I almost put the airplane into a stall. Mm-hmm. And it only had one engine, but I was pulling up too fast or something. Mm-hmm. And I think it shook up the pilot. Because after we landed, he said, my advice to you would be really don't pursue a flying career. He told me my peripheral vision wasn't good enough. Oh, wow. And I didn't like it anyway, because I'm not mechanical. Mm-hmm. You got to go out there and look at the engines and make sure they're not leaking. Mm-hmm. You have to be pretty mechanical too, to be a good pilot. Mm-hmm. That wasn't me, but it was fun, you know. But at the same time, people were jumping out of airplanes, you know. Parachuting was getting very, very popular, skydiving. Mm-hmm. And I was living in Chicago when I first started flying, and I had an opportunity to go skydiving. Mm-hmm. But then all of a sudden there was a terrible accident and something like 16 people died.
Wow.
Skydiving.
Wow.
So it was kind of like, okay, I get the message. I'm not going to do that. Yeah. But I compare taking the leap of faith to skydiving, because when I took the leap of faith and said, nope, I'm not going to listen to that doctor that wants me to have surgery or die. If I don't listen to him, I'm going to take a leap and try spiritual healing. Mm-hmm. And it really is like jumping across a chasm, because you're living in the 3D world, you're jumping into the spiritual dimension, which is not really familiar territory yet, because you've been using your 3D senses to survive. But you have this intuitive feeling that there's got to be something to it. Mm-hmm. If it's happened to other people, then why not? Mm-hmm. So I took the leap. And just like skydiving, I landed on my feet.
Nice.
Yeah.
Good. Well, this is, you know, if this book is awesome, like it's a really deep book. And
it is deep. Yeah.
If you want to be part of Rebecca's live book study, that's starting in February, we'll get you the dates. We'll put some links down. We haven't finalized that just yet. We're putting all the material together. And I hope that you liked, you know, meeting Rebecca. And I'm sure we're going to do some more of these and do some deeper dives. And, you know, Rebecca is a manifesting specialist. So if that's something that interests you, definitely join her book study and or even join her mastermind that she has. I think she's got some spaces open left on her mastermind still. Mm-hmm. So definitely get in touch. We'll put some links at the bottom. And or if you know anyone that might be interested in learning more, attending her live book study, let her know. We might have a limited space. So you definitely want to sign up sooner than later. There's no advantage to waiting till last minute or signing up early. It's all the same price. Rebecca just really wanted to start getting this message out. And, you know, I'm happy that she's here as one of our founding members in Acorn Life Mastery. And I hope you like this this call today. So any final words, Rebecca?
Yeah, I'd just like to add, those people that join my book study will also have the opportunity, because it'll be live. You know, if there's something specifically that they would like me to address, we can do that. Yeah, I know everybody is looking always. I mean, we as long as we're in the three-dimensional world, there's always something we're working on. And it could be in the category of health, wealth, happiness, friendship, purpose, whatever. If you've got questions, I'll be there willing to offer whatever insights I have. And I also want to mention that you would want to buy my book, and you can get it for $9.95 if you go to my website, rebeccatripp.com. I will send you a signed copy. You can also get it through my app called Inner Power with Rebecca Tripp, which is on Android and Apple. So maybe you can put that underneath the sites where they can. But you must sign up for Acorn in order to sign up. And that's free. The Acorn Life Mastery community is a free community that has amazing things to offer people. And you want to sign up on that.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for your time, Rebecca. And, you know, we're looking to fill up her spots. And so definitely reserve your spots early in advance. And we hope to see you there and connect you with Rebecca.